Our reading from the Epistle of James this morning describes a particular moment of crisis. It is possible that it is a hypothetical moment of crisis, but it still evokes a certain kind of crisis for the audience, even us. Writing to Jewish Christians outside of Israel, James describes a situation when two people enter their gathering. One who displays their wealth in their appearance, their clothes and their adornments, and one whose poverty is evident in what they are wearing. James places a certain emphasis on their visible differences, saying nothing about the behavior or character of the two individuals. The only thing we know about them is how they appear to our eyes. So what do? James invites us in our imaginations to an encounter that an encounter that might not actually be all that strange or peculiar, an encounter that we might not have paid any special attention to. After all, for us, for the Christians of that time, any normal day might have an encounter with people of obvious wealth or obvious poverty, whether we know them or not. We encounter them, or they encounter us. We usually don't think twice at all about how we respond or relate to them. We might just speak or act almost unconsciously without even recognizing this moment for what it is, a moment of critical decision, a moment of crisis. James lays the potential response out. If you take notice, if you look upon the one wearing fine clothes and say, have a seat here, in a good place, the place of honor, while to the one who is poor you say, stand over there, or sit by my footstool, have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? James describes a certain failure, the failure to notice this moment for the crisis that it is, a failure to see the real urgency of this unspectacular encounter and to act in a way that is in keeping with what we claim to be real. Has not God chosen the poor in the world to be rich in faith and to be heirs of the kingdom that he has promised to those who love him, he says. For those of you who are more familiar with the New Testament, this sentence from James sounds an awful lot like Paul's words in 1 Corinthians. Consider your own call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful or of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to abolish things that are, so that no one might boast in the presence of God. The problem for James in our passage, as we heard, is human judgment. Because we look out at the world, we look at other human beings, and we cast judgment based entirely upon what we believe is real and true and how what their appearance means for what is real and true to us. Our judgment, our perception of the world and others around us is guided by where we put our faith. If, for example, we believe that the way the world works is that only the strong survive, then we will judge others in the world in accordance with that belief, favoring displays of strength and power. For all of us, with our lacking and harmful human judgment, James's word is this: so speak and so act as those who are to be judged by the law of liberty. So speak and so act as those who are to be judged by the law of liberty. For judgment will be without mercy to anyone who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. This is the potentially frightening antidote to our harmful human judgment, understanding that we are judged. We are judged. Isn't this the great irony of judgment? We judge, yet we hate to be judged. We realize how inevitable it seems to make some kinds of judgment of others in our life, that in some ways we cannot not judge the world around us. We perceive, we make a judgment, and we respond. Sometimes in the blink of an eye, it almost seems inescapable for us. Yet there might be few things more frightening than the prospect of being judged. If it isn't frightening, then at least it isn't welcome. Who wouldn't avoid the prospect of being put under the microscope, especially when it has to do with judgment upon our living, our acting, our behaving, our speaking, or even our thinking? To many of us, James's words may not sound as good news at all. Speak and act as if I am being judged? I mean, it kind of sounds like surveillance, doesn't it? Or maybe it even sounds like a sidewalk preacher shouting at us to beware of the great coming judgment. Remember, though, James isn't giving a hellfire and brimstone sermon here. This isn't necessarily some kind of final judgment that takes place at the end of one's life. He's not trying to coerce his audience into believing something through fear of hell and punishment. None of this kind of stuff is mentioned here. In fact, James seems to give some hint towards this judgment upon us being something that is kind of good, freeing even, something that might make a difference in our judgment, in our behavior and attitude towards others. It is judgment by the law of liberty, he says, of liberty. It is a judgment ruled by mercy, he writes. Now let us not also forget the context of James's words here. Again, this is not the end of someone's life. The judgment here isn't in the midst of some dramatic or theatrical moment that would naturally draw attention. James isn't talking about moments of war or hysteria even. He's simply talking about our response to encountering people, strangers, or maybe being encountered by people or strangers. James wants us to recognize that this more or less unexciting encounter with people is actually a critical moment, a moment of crisis, a moment of judgment. But whereas we might unconsciously assume this to be a moment where we are set up as the judge of others, we should rather speak and act, James says, towards others as those who are judged. Our judgment is apparently not one way, in other words. In our judging, we too are judged. In our perceiving, we are being perceived. We reveal ourselves in how we respond. This again is crisis. Literally, this is the Greek word for judgment here. Crisis, that's the Greek word. The encounter with the stranger is the moment of crisis when in our judging, we are judged. It is a crisis because while an encounter with strangers may not be dramatic, it may even be common, it is still of the utmost importance. This is perhaps what we see Jesus have such mastery over in the Mark passage today, but really in all of his encounters. He never takes for granted an encounter with anybody, whether it is the Syrophoenician woman, the deaf and mute man, or every other encounter with a human being. He shows it to be this moment of crisis where a judgment of mercy can prevail, where the response can be self-giving. In a way, our response to every human being before us, especially the poor or weak or shamed or dishonorable, the way we judge, treat, speak to, even think about them is of eternal importance. In our judgment of them, in our response to them, we are judged. This is the surprising turn of Matthew 25, if you remember, when the king and judge tells those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me." Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? When was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you? And the king will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did it to me. This is the moment of crisis we face in every encounter. In our judgment, we are judged. And in our merciful judgment of others, in our mercy, we come to discover the merciful judgment of God over us. We find that we are judged by the merciful God revealed in Jesus of Nazareth. And thank goodness, because the reality is that we haven't always treated people with the respect they deserve. We have judged poorly. We have shown partiality and discrimination and superiority. We have all participated in terrible human judgment that oppresses rather than liberates. We all have. We are all responsible for some kind of pain in others. But there is mercy for us. And because there is mercy for us, we can be transformed and be merciful. In the moment of crisis, when we face our judgment in our encounter with the other, we are freed to seek their freedom, their peace, and their well-being, all because we have been shown mercy. So much of all of this is at play as we come to the communion table together this morning. The bread and wine is an encounter of sorts, or maybe it should be. It is the replaying of an encounter, at least. In receiving this meal, we are returned to the great moment of crisis in the hours before Jesus' arrest. In the Last Supper that Jesus had with his disciples, was not just a nostalgic moment we love to recall for all the good memories. It's almost the opposite. This meal carries the memory of false hope, of betrayal, of desertion. For the disciples, it brings up a past in which ignorance and pride and the rejection of Jesus' account of his destiny in favor of power fantasies of their own led the disciples into their most tragic failure, their indirect but very real share in the ruin of the Lord. Yet Jesus, even as he sees their rejection taking shape in the meal, nonetheless gives himself to his betrayers in the breaking of bread. The meal restores precisely the juxtaposition, the poignant juxtaposition of his unfailing mercy and grace and the rejection, distortion, and betrayal of it by his disciples. In the words of Rowan Williams, quote, "We may pause here for a moment to recall that this juxtaposition is built into every Christian celebration of communion. We are reminded in the introduction of the communion, you're going to hear it again tonight, that the sacrament of Jesus' self-gift originates in the same night that he was betrayed." That's how every communion starts, in the same night that he was betrayed. Those who eat at Jesus' table are his betrayers, then as now. Yet from the death and hell to which our betrayal condemns him, he returns to break his bread with us as before. Communion is never a simple fellowship meal. It's not just a fellowship meal here. Not even a simple fellowship meal with Jesus. Its imagery always and necessarily operates between two poles of Maundy Thursday and Easter Sunday, between Gethsemane and Emmaus, between the upper room before the crucifixion and the upper room to which the risen Jesus comes. All meals with Jesus after Calvary speak of the restoration of a fellowship broken by human infidelity. The wounded body and the shed blood are inescapably present. We do not remember a distant meal in Jerusalem, nor even a distant death. We are made present to ourselves in the meal as people complicit in the betrayal and death of Jesus, and yet still called and still accepted, still companions of Christ in the strictest sense, those who break bread with him. End quote. In a way, the gift of communion is to willingly enter into that moment of crisis, an encounter with our merciful judge, so that as we go, we may have eyes to see and ears to hear the moment of crisis that ever befalls us in our perpetual, yet ordinary encounter with others. So as we come to the table together, may we open our hearts and our minds to receive from God, so that we may speak and act as those who are judged by the law of liberty. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.